Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to Achtung Norwalk, broadcasting from the beautiful South Berlin. Set no substitute.
Hello, dear listeners. Welcome to a special edition of Achtung Norwalk. Joining me to try and mark the Remembrance Week in our own way, joining me is my co-conspirator, Mr. Neil Fissler. Welcome to the show, Neil.
Hello, Nick. How are you going, mate? Good afternoon, everyone.
Going well. I thought the we're just talking off air, listeners, about the club's ceremonies before the derby game at the weekend. We do this kind of thing very, very well, Neil, as a club, and I thought it was a really touching and moving ceremony on Saturday. Simple and yet effective all for it.
I must admit, the last post and then the poem before it always kind of gets you, doesn't it?
It does.
And it brings the silence. What got me, because obviously I wasn't there, was it's total silence and then a bloody train goes past, just to give you a little bit of dose of reality.
Yeah.
It wasn't, you could have heard a pin drop and then all of a sudden a train goes flying past. And
yeah, very well marked.
We do these things brilliantly at Millwall. I know that we are. I know that as Millwall fans, we're very quick to criticise and we do jump on certain things. But Saturday, Mel did an amazing job putting the collection together.
As ever, same each year. I mean, I actually hadn't had a chance, listeners, to buy a poppy, but I took the chance at the Den on Saturday to get one. There's some soldiers there doing the selling part, and that's just nice. I think one of the ceremony, as you say, there was a train that trundled past, but somehow, I mean, for me, I suppose it broke the silence in that sense, but it just reminds you that, as with some of the things we might touch on in this conversation, Neil, there's conflict and there's people involved. And life continues despite we don't have a conflict now, thankfully. But you know, trains run past, life goes on in the midst of some very difficult situations sometimes. And the reason we're doing this, listeners, is we're trying to do our own version of we've covered, Neil, over time, plenty of war heroes from who've played for the club and situations, but I thought it might be nice just to look at how the particularly second world, how it affected Millwall Football Club, because it impacted all of life, but we're a Millwall podcast, so it's just interesting to look how it actually affected us as a football club, because it had a major effect on us, on our standing in the game and long-term prospects, really, didn't it?
Yeah, we were just starting to go places, and I think we spoke about it on the fixture show the other week, didn't we? We got to an FA Cup semi-final.
Yeah.
We'd been promoted from Division 3 South.
Yeah.
I think we'd won that, hadn't we? And we were spending some money. I think we actually broke our transfer record at some point in all of that.
Yeah, we did. I'm just reading. I make no apologies, listeners, for referring a lot to James Murray's Lions of the South on this, because it's a bit of a definitive history and it covers this period quite well. It's like you get a lot of websites, magazines, even than books. What if this happened in history? What if that didn't happen? Where would it take you? But for me, it was quite a small scale thing in a way, given the major events we're describing. But what if? what if the war hadn't have broken out? Well, you know, reading James Murray's book, now we were very, very well financially placed at the start of the conflict, 1939-40. We'd signed Macmillan, purchased Macmillan and BT, don't know their first names.
Walter Macmillan.
And then we'd installed 4,000 seats in the main stand. I think that held 8,000. Did I read that? That'd be the old stand that would eventually, we'd lose that during the course of the war years. But we were gearing up for First Division football, Neil.
Yeah, there was ambition there, wasn't there? Little old Millwall that had been plodding along in Third Division South, occasionally in the Second Division.
Yep.
From when we got elected into the league in, what, 1920, whatever it was.
Yep.
And we'd got our act together. We had a brilliant squad.
Yeah.
There was the finance there, which, as we know in Millwall history, isn't always available, is it? It's one of those things. I know we've spoke about it with Merv, haven't we? The good times always seem to follow the bad times, and the bad times last a little while, and then
followed by disaster normally. But yeah, I mean, it's just fascinating to read this stuff, listeners. I mean, these are sentences that are quite hard to read in a way, because Millwall, at the outbreak of war in the last few days of peacetime, were, along with Arsenal, remained amongst the best supported clubs in London. And, you know, and we were very well placed financially as a consequence of that. There were even plans I read for the stand to become a two-tier stand, a little bit like what you might have got at Highbury, something along those lines. And then, of course, you know, conflict breaks out on the Polish-German border, instigated by the German regime, and also the Soviet Union invaded. And next thing you know, the world's at war, as the program used to have it, which would affect everyone across the board, but Millwall especially, because one of the earliest restrictions imposed on football, Neil, was a gate restriction. I mean, just reading James Murray's book, we go from being one of the wealthiest clubs in the game to being on our financial knees by Christmas, because restrictions are imposed on gates, and 8,000 maximum attendance. I suppose that would be because of the danger of bombing raids with so many people gathered in one place.
Yeah, that's right. Obviously, funnily enough, I'd made the note here. It was Sir Philip Game, who was the Metropolitan Police Commissioner at the time, imposed a crippling 8,000 limit on crowds. And in Millwall's case, that really was crippling.
Yeah.
Eventually, I think what happened was they actually lifted that to about 15,000. But each turnstile had a numbered ticket, apparently. And once those tickets had sold out, it was up to the police as to whether or not they let any more people in.
Yeah.
And in Millwall's case, it must have been a tight squeeze. And being where we were, obviously the Surrey Docks were prime target during the Blitz, weren't they? They'd have been...
Absolutely. Very, very difficult. I mean, just reading gate restrictions in danger areas, as you've just described, Surrey Docks, Bermondsey, industrial dockside areas. Gate restrictions in those areas were set at 8,000. Elsewhere in the provinces, 15,000 could gather, but 8,000 only at football matches. A rumour spread, this is in early 1939, so we hadn't really, the war followed a strange early pattern, listeners. It was something called the phony war, where although there was a conflict, there was no clash of arms at this early stage, and certainly I don't think there was any air raids until 1940, but certainly they were operating under the precaution that bombing would spread terror and casualties on a grand scale. But there was a rumour spread that this 8,000 limit had been increased, which wasn't the case. And as James puts it, a near riot ensued outside the den with people trying to get in to watch football, and they weren't allowed in. So very little changes in this life, especially down Coldblow Lane. I mean, probably the first major time that we need, or date that we need to really consider, is the start of what became known as the Blitzkrieg in September of 1940. The Battle of Britain began really in I think it was about June, July after the fall of France. And as much as the Germans tried to knock out Fighter Command, they couldn't. So they had to switch tactics, which involved the mass bombing of the industrial centres of Britain, in particular London, in particular the Surrey Docks. And that all began on September the 7th. And I think you got a great report, Neil, of a game. Was it against Charlton? A game played on that day, on the opening day of the Blitzkrieg?
Yeah, it was. Funnily enough, we were just talking about it off air, and I was reading about it earlier on in a great book. If anybody goes on Amazon, it's called Gas Masks for Goalposts, Football in Britain During the Second World War, by Anton Rippon. You can pick it up for a couple of quid. It is a fantastic history book. But a report in the Sunday Mirror, of all places, and it's just brilliant. I'll just quickly read some of it. They played football in the war zone yesterday. London area matches ended with Goering's bombers overhead, chased by our fighters and fired at by our AA guns. Players and crowds turned never a hair. Good God almighty, they all think they're Shakespeare, don't they?
Never a hair.
Some matches ended on the sirens. But don't let that worry you. Results stand on finishing on the finishing score for league and pools purposes. So they were thinking of this Paddy Power nonsense, was there?
Well, nothing changes.
In the Charlton versus Millwall match, the players had begun to troop off when they heard the warning. The referee called the players together and told them there was only a minute left. This was actually slightly wrong. I think there was an air raid, obviously, and shrapnel from the nearby anti-aircraft guns started to fall on the stadium. They were determined to allow us to beat Charlton, were they? A minute to go, everybody runs and takes cover, and
shrapnel falling from the sky is
incredible. Guys, you have lengths that Charlton go to. To avoid a defeat by little old Millwall, eh?
Hermann Goering above, the RAF chasing after the MacCat flying up and the shrapnel falling on people in the ground. I think I would have turned a hair if that happened to me. I think I would have run for cover.
Real wall would have stayed on the terraces.
Yes, I think I would have had to check out of that one. I'm just looking at Lions of the South. I think they... They also mentioned an interesting, I mean, our manager at the time, of course, listeners and Neil and I have mentioned him a good few times, a wonderful character. I think that's probably the best way I can put it, Charles Hewitt.
Cheerful Charlie.
They just mentioned a game we play against Arsenal in the war. Football had been reorganised into a war league, London, so to try and restrict travelling, they played a lot of local derbies. But prior to the Arsenal game, Charlie Hewitt was driving on a Cheshire road with his wife, visiting relatives, when a German bomber swooped low out of the sky above him, frightening the Millwall Supremo out of his skin. He would actually become, I think he had a naval connection, Hewitt. He became Lieutenant Hewitt, I think I've read, as in other reports. So that was an early introduction to the harsh realities in Cheshire of wartime life. And as you say there, Neil, I mean, the idea of shrapnel falling from the sky onto a stadium for people. Different times. I think that's probably the best way.
Well, we worry about COVID
or ice on the terraces in cold weather. I mean, I can't quite match the descriptive power of that one. I've pulled out a game played against Crystal Palace, and I think it had been a week or two before the print of the Croydon Observer, which was the 21st of September 1940. So bear in mind, listeners, that the Blitzkrieg...
I think it was actually the following week, Nick,
right,
that game was played. So
air raid sirens stopping Palace their strength not tested at Millwall. Hitler's Bombers did not give Crystal Palace a fair chance to test their strength against Millwall at the Den on Saturday last. After about 30 minutes play, when Millwall were leading 1-0, the air raid siren sounded and the game was eventually abandoned. I suppose they would take the players off and clear the area as best they could and wait and see if there was going to be an all clear, and then you could carry on playing football.
mad, isn't it? Absolutely mad to think
it's mad. I mean, the other thing, this is clearly a Croydon paper, because this Palace, they're talking about Palace and their strength not being tested. Leave aside the Hermann Göring Luftwaffe. We were leading. I don't really go into that. We were winning the game and they've taken them off the pitch. Fascinating. So, I mean, this is just a little side piece that I'm looking as I'm reading the newspaper here. There was a well-known boxer's lucky escape. This is also in the Croydon Observer. Jim Tuohig, the print is a little bit wayward there. A well-known middleweight who had a lucky escape, picture of him in boxing stance, when he had a lucky escape when bombs fell on a working neighbourhood in a district near London in the early hours of Wednesday morning. As ever, they were always very vague on dates and vague on locations where bombing happened, because they didn't want to give the information to the enemy. There was certainly rumours of a spy network that would feed back, information, that kind of thing. So there we are. One game is abandoned because of ACAC, and the other one because of an air raid. Wonderful stuff. These were wartime leagues. These were organised and reorganised through the course of the whole 6 years of the conflict. Variations on a theme as they try to find.
Yeah, they regionalize things because obviously they didn't want teams traipsing all over the country, did they? And don't forget, a lot of teams had players called up.
Yeah.
A lot of teams relied on guest players. I know we've done a couple of shows on Millwall guest players, haven't we?
Guesting because they were in services and around the country.
Yeah. So quite often, I think a little bit later in the war, I think we played West Ham and Bill Voysey had to come out of retirement and play himself.
To the field.
Because he couldn't find anybody else to play. We only had 10 players.
I mean, the other thing to say is, and we were touching on this before we started recording, listeners, it sometimes strikes me the further we get away from these times, the more distance there is between us. And there's a tendency to think of the people that endured the conflict and lived through it as somehow different, when in actual fact they're us, in a sense, just in a different time. So with all the good, the bad and the indifferent that comes with life generally, I mean, I'm just reading here that, and I can understand this, that some players in the initial stages of the conflict were refusing to do football training. And the reason that they were refusing to do football training was because their pay had been set at a mere 30 shillings a match, which I've worked out be about 60, 70 pounds. That's how much they would, in modern terms. So they had a pay restriction of 30 shillings a match, and they didn't think that wasn't worth their while. And I find it interesting because people are people, and there's a war on, and yes, you know, you're playing football for the entertainment, but you're not going to do it for nothing. And yet they were kind of refusing to play for such low wages, which is an interesting insight into people's mindsets at that time, in a way.
Yeah, footballers, they weren't very well paid, were they? They were on a par with the average man in the street, I think, back then.
And, £1 in, I looked up on the Bank of England site, and £1 in 1940 would be worth about £57-58 now. So they were being paid 30 shillings, so that'd be about £1.50. So you're talking about 70, 80 quidish, something like that, which they refused to do. As James here puts it, the meagre returns for their skills. They were angered by these meagre returns. I think the club was restricted in terms of its ability to pay as well. I mean, there was a pay cap generally, wasn't there, in the game? But they weren't taking gate receipts on the scale they needed.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, well, as we said, Yeah, the Metropolitan Police imposed a limit on how many people could get in. So, and I don't know how much it was to get in back then, but I bet you, but 9,000 didn't really cover it that much.
No.
Then
no.
You would have had rationing, so you couldn't, rationing had probably been brought in by then. So there probably wasn't the refreshment sales. I don't know what refreshment sales were like back then. I guess it was just a meat pie or something.
Meat pie and a beer or something.
Bovril or something like that. But
interesting also, in the early days, I think they couldn't keep to this, but early on, Millwall declined to use guest players. They preferred to stick with their own men, as they put it, as James puts it, to whom they'd rather pay the 30 shillings as a loyalty. They couldn't sustain that. Men would be joining the forces, I noticed here Tom Brodie became a PT instructor in the army, and they would be sent away, and it just wasn't possible to continue without that guest system. It was the only way that the clubs could function at that time.
Yeah, but a lot of clubs actually used that guest function very well. Millwall being Millwall, I suppose. We want to do things differently, don't they?
We do. I always, by Christmas, and I'm going to guess that's Christmas 1939, listeners, the Lions were in a perilous financial plight, and the subject of closing the club had been discussed at the highest levels, at the boardroom level. Prior to the war, we got used to big crowds, 30 to 40 then, and now they're down to 8,000 max. So, the club was in trouble.
Achtung, Mehlball.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
But one thing never changes, Neil, and that's the when we play Crystal Palace, there's always drama. And I put them on Twitter actually the other day. We've already had one Palace game delayed by an air raid siren, but I found another one. This is a great report. I just love it. I thought I'd mention it again just because I've put it out there. This is from. The paper is the Croydon Times, Sunday Dispatch, 29th of September 1940, Sunday Dispatch. Referee calls soccer teams off of the Palace football field. Millwall captain ordered off after a protest against the penalty award. This is by a journalist called Russell Stannard, who says, and I can't help but read this in a rather hoity-toity voice, that in a long experience of football troubles and scenes, in inverted commas, he cannot recall anything like what happened on the Crystal Palace ground in the game of Millwall. The award of a penalty kick started a rumpus, Neil. The kick was given for a foul on Gillespie of Palace. Strong Millwall protests followed, and twice the ball was kicked away from the penalty spot by Millwall players. Once the ball went into the crowd, trouble then began between a few Millwall players and a section of the crowd at the back of the goal. The referee ordered off Millwall's international winger and captain J.R. Smith. There was another incident, and then the referee took both teams to the dressing rooms where they were absent for 5 minutes. Then the game was resumed without J.R. Smith. Eventually, Palace winning 2-1, and as it says here, the Luftwaffe didn't even drop an incendiary bomb. Sounds like a bit of a scuffle, doesn't it?
Okay. Mate, it sounds like, yeah, but it sounds like we always get shit refs, don't we?
Doesn't say where he's from. They've got another report which does say where he's from. I do think there's a bit of that in that. I mean, you know, I think one of the things that strike me, I always remember as a kid, you know, I'm talking about the 70s, and you get your grandfather and your dad telling you how these modern players, you know, we had none of this brawling and fighting back in the 70s. There's all sorts. We had none of this when we were young, and you had no means of disproving them back then. I had no internet and I had no access to the British newspaper archive, because that would have been evidence to show that was all bollocks.
Yeah, but
it happened.
Yeah, but that would have been. Yeah, but that would have been a case for the. Yeah, but that would have been a case for the defence, wouldn't it? That one,
absolutely. Oh dear. So yeah, there we are. So that was in September. Then, just to continue the theme, there were the following March we play Palace again at Selhurst Park. Croydon Times reports the referee was handled roughly this time. Now this bloke is a Mr. R. Greenwood, not Ron Greenwood, I don't think. Mr. R.C. Greenwood of Upper Norwood, who awarded Palace a penalty in a 5-3 loss for the Lions. Again, the referee called both teams off the field to cool off for 10 minutes this time. He's taken it up by fire. But in the award of a penalty, a crowd of Millwall players surrounded the referee, and two of them took him by the jacket and shook him forcibly. The referee struggled free, and play was held up for some minutes whilst he cautioned the players. And then that was the referee continued, this is in the Palace paper, and the referee continued to be flustered by the vigorous tactics of Millwall in the second half. Palace deserved their victory. Sounds like there was love lost between Millwall
and the local referee, because Upper Norwood being actually Crystal Palace, that's right. Not make too many bones about it.
No,
yeah, the guy was probably on the payroll of
absolutely corrupt
anyway. Yeah.
Getting 30 shillings of them.
R.C. Greenwood's relatives are listening to this. Tough. Yeah.
I wonder if in relation to the Greenwood family, it would like they to become West Ham icons. I don't know. There we are.
Yeah, but let's not have any more conspiracy theories. It just goes to show that there was passion there, that even though the war's raging.
That's right.
And you're not playing your normal league games. There's still
human life going on.
Isn't there? That there's still professional pride, and
that's right. And they give a shit. You know, they want to win this game. Yes, you know, you can talk 1941, 1940. These were dark times for the country. We were fighting alone against the Germans, with the Empire forces, of course. But you know. Invasion was expected. There was still a strong chance of that, even in 1941. So it's interesting that even under
Millwall players are still kicking the shit out of the referee.
Life goes on, and yeah, that's right. That to rough up the referee. I think it's just a wonderful insight into how human nature doesn't change no matter what the times. And on the same line, really, I think now I'm going to twist and turn that theme, if I may. We've mentioned Charlie Hewitt already, but there was a wonderful, I say wonderful, fantastic to read of this stuff all these years afterwards. Okay, so he'd been sacked after an FA inquiry for being on the fiddle. He'd allegedly been signing chitties for £1, expenses, for 10 shillings, sorry, 10 shillings expenses, and when actually they'd been claiming £1. I mean, the sums are so paltry that it's just incredible that this had been going on. But and this came to light to the FA's inquiry notice, causing some boardroom kerfuffle by a disgruntled clerk in the Millwall admin office who said that one of his colleagues got to watch Millwall whilst he had to do the books. And because of that, he put the bubble in about Charlie claiming £1 when he was signing for 10 shillings. And that led to him being sacked as Millwall manager in 1940.
There was probably also Charlie had probably rubbed the guy up the wrong way. Charlie rubbed quite a few people up the wrong way, if you speak to players from that and later eras.
Yeah. He seems like a man of some.
I think he had a bit of a drink problem.
It was there was a wonderful description. I haven't got it to hand in James Murray's book, but it described Charlie Hewitt as an account of his personality. The kind of man, I'm paraphrasing slightly, listeners, but it was to the effect that he was a kind of man that would, there was his opinion, which was correct, and he would not entertain any other opinion that was not correct.
He once actually banned a journalist from the Daily Express.
Right.
He banned him in 1939, I think it was, and the ban was still in place 10 years later. And Dave Sullivan, or a number of years later, I think it could have been 10, and Dave Sullivan, Mill historian, said, yeah, can you find anything out about this? So I replied to him, well, Charlie's not one to hold a grudge, was he? I know there was a little thing about the conflict getting in the way. But I think if Charlie held a grudge against you,
Well, I mean, it's a good point, actually, because again, I keep returning to this fundamental point, listeners, that the nation was in peril whilst all this drama played out. You know, they really were Nazi troops in Calais ready to invade if they could. Thankfully, they couldn't. So the country was in you know, its darkest hour, and yet somehow at Millwall we managed to sack our manager over 10 shillings, fiddle, and then engage in a slander allegation in which the club's chairman, Tom Thorne, who I believe, Neil, correct me if I'm wrong, was one of the original men who formed the club on the Isle of Dogs. I think the Thorns go back a long way to the island, certainly.
That's right. And then the Thorn that I believe sold, he was going to sell up to Asda. He was a distant relation of some description. So they'd been around the club for a number of years. In fact, it would actually be quite good to do a show at some point. I know we've got so many ideas, and
we're not short of ideas on this show, listeners.
Yeah.
I hope we're not short of listeners for it, but anyway, we'll see about that. We've got plenty of ideas, Tom, but there clearly had been ructions in the boardroom over the wisdom of proceeding with these, what should we call it, a bit of fiddle, I don't know, signing for 10 shillings and claiming a pound level, literally. Anyway, it seems that in the course of a, I don't know if it'd be a drink-fueled boardroom meeting, Neil, but Thomas Thorne was alleged to have called Lieutenant William Charles Hewitt, manager and secretary of Millwall, a quisling, no less, in the course of this stormy boardroom meeting. Quisling, for younger listeners, if we have any younger listeners, a byword for traitor, was a Norwegian politician who betrayed his country to the Germans. So there's no lower insult, particularly then, even it still carries power to this day, to be a quisling. And I think that was the level of debate that took place in the Millwall boardroom. So Hewitt took a libel action against your slander, I should be correct, which he would actually win. The FA found against Hewitt. But he took a courtroom action against Thorne for slander, and he would win £100 worth of damages.
You were not one to hold a grudge, though, Charlie, was he, as we've said?
No.
So he was very quick to turn to the court, wasn't he? It's just unbelievable. Can you imagine, if we put this into modern context, COVID is raging out of control. And then behind the scenes at Millwall Football Club, Gary Rowett has badly fallen out with John Berylson and Steve Kavanagh. Yeah, there are thousands of people dying. And
a foreign power is imminent, you know.
Yeah, can you imagine what social media and Hoff would have made of all
run
of
amok.
Yeah, back then the reporting was quite tame, wasn't it?
But it was very dry. They would have gone to town with it nowadays. I mean, just to repeat, £1 in 1940 terms is £57.50, I think I read on the Bank of England. If he's been fiddling, he's been signing out a pound, he's basically been fiddling signing for 25 quid and taking 50. But yeah, these are the levels that we're talking about. So quite paltry sums. And for that, the club tears itself apart in the courtroom. And eventually Charlie is awarded. Charlie, I sound like I know him now. Lieutenant Charles Hewitt, I should call him to me. Lieutenant Hewitt is awarded £100 of damage, so about 500 quid in modern terms, as a result. Well, maybe more, probably a little bit more, 5,000 maybe.
In an inconsiderable sum of money.
No, in wartime. And that was the end of it. This report is from the Nottingham Journal, dated 2nd of April. Lieutenant Charles Hewitt was awarded £100 damages when the hearing of slander brought against him by against the club's chairman was concluded at the King's Bench yesterday. Just to put a little sad twist on it, I find it quite, because we're laughing, because it's got this humorous tone to it now, but the chairman, Tom Thorne, would die 1 month later in May 1941. He died on his way home from church in Devon. He was 70. Following, and they mentioned the slander action brought by the club's former manager, Lieutenant Hewitt, which is kind of like a sad twist to what otherwise would be a slightly amusing story. But clearly the weight of all that, and come back to the point you made earlier on, Neil, that people care about Millwall, and that would have weighed heavy on Tom Thorne's shoulders, I think, that whole action.
Yeah, he was a master builder, and devoted everything to Millwall. Millwall was this guy's life.
Yeah, yeah.
I think he was a member of the FA Council. And
he was well placed, yeah.
So this was a guy who joined the club. I think he probably attended a lot of our early matches.
He would have been there on the island. You know, yeah. That's when the... I'm sure I've seen... When we did some of the shows about Bob Hunter and the early years on the Isle of Dogs, there's a photo, I'm sure it's Tom Thorne with Bob Hunter, these legends of the...
Yeah, Tom Thorne, he was connected with the club from 1888. Yeah. Although he didn't join the board of directors until 1901. This would have been...
Major name.
A guy that's seen us play virtually everywhere.
Yeah. Listeners might be asking, what's all this got to do with remembrance? And my answer to that is... It's a tangent in a sense, but I suppose it shows the point of remembrance for me, listeners, is that it marks the loss of these events. It also shows it should demonstrate that life goes on around it. And this is life, you know, in all of its rich tapestry. And this was going on at Millwall whilst the nation was in peril. And you can say it's trivial, Neil, but that's what happens, isn't it? You know.
Yeah, well, we've done plenty of shows on the players that unfortunately paid the ultimate sacrifice, and we've covered guests. And it was just when you tweeted this out the other day, it just seemed like just a good excuse to spend a Monday afternoon. We don't mean to trivialise it, and we hope that people...
It's not meant in that sense, no.
It's just that it just gives a sense of the world collapsing.
Yeah.
And Millwall imploding from the inside.
Really. And people still finding time to wage very personal disputes, in the midst of it all.
Personal vendettas, weren't they?
Yeah. So it's as much for me, listeners, and you might disagree with me, and I'd welcome any thoughts on that? I mean, it's as much part of the story as the acts of bravery and all the rest of it, which are, which we've marked on previous shows. So it would just be interesting to show that in the middle of it all, you can still have comedy mixed with tragedy, I suppose.
Achtung, Mehlball.
Neil, we move along, mate. And my next report I found was a report dated... it's actually from Dundee's paper, Dundee Telegraph. Famous incident where the ground took a bomb hit in 1943. And this is probably one of the most unlucky incidents. I mean two strokes of bad luck, really. One was the bombing, and then obviously the main stand would burn down shortly afterwards. But this was an incident in May where what was by then, the Luftwaffe were not waging anything like the mass raids. They were not able to hit London on the same scale that they could in the early part of the war. Losses generally had become too much. And they were waging what became known as tip-and-run raids, where individual bombers would fly over and quite literally find something to aim at, or if you could aim at something, great. If not, they just unload their bombs anywhere and get the hell out of there if they could. Although these, a little bit of research, I don't think this bomber got away. It was actually shot down. But having dropped a high-explosive bomb on the Den, causing very famous damage. There's some wonderful photos, and one in the Baldrum of the damaged Den, certainly one in Lions of the South. It was quite a device. A metal crush barrier was sent 200 yards in the air, 200 yards in the air from the explosion. It's incredible.
That would have been quite some sight, wouldn't it? You wouldn't want to have been there to have actually watched it. But
No, you might not have lasted long. I mean, there's an image of the volunteers after there was due to be a local cup final. London Senior Cup final was due to be played at the Den between Dulwich Hamlet and Tooting and Mitcham on the following Easter Monday. I mean, the devastation of the... Anyone that was at Coldblow Lane will know where I'm talking. It was from about halfway along the halfway line going towards the dog track end, that whole kind of sloping terracing area as it went down to, there's a floodlight there in our time. There was a clock there, I think, in the old days. Is basically rubble and rubble strewn across the pitch. And amazingly, volunteer labour, Neil, got the ground together for Dulwich to beat Tooting 5-4 on the 26th of April 1943. Incredible.
Yeah, we go on about the Blitz spirit, don't they?
Yeah.
But that's what they very much did. Yeah, they weren't going to let a little thing like a bomb get in the way of a game of football, were they?
No. get your priorities right.
Yeah, but they're to be admired, really, aren't they? That they can and get all of this stuff.
Yeah.
Off the pitch, and you'll worry about it later.
I mean, the images are remarkable. The old roof of Den, those that were there will know what I'm talking about, the roof on the halfway line. There's certainly about the end nearest the explosion is shattered. It strengthens up as it goes further away. Otherwise, that whole corner of the terracing is effectively a crater with rubble. And there's about 12, 15 blokes in this picture clearing the rubble from the pitch to enable a local cup final to take place a few days later. It's absolutely incredible. And this would be followed, Neil, of course, by the other disaster, which was the discarded cigarette that burned down the main stand. Again, a showpiece stand. I'm just going to read from Lions of the South, if I may. The real fireworks were still to come after the bomb explosion. Millwall's players were changing at Selhurst Park after a 4-2 friendly, whilst back at the Den, ground staff spotted a small fire in the main stand. That was half an hour after the end of the... within that Dulwich Tooting final, actually. The stand was totally engulfed in flames. 8,000 seats and the distinctive gable in the 350-foot showpiece wooden structure perishing in the lapping flames as pools of black smoke lifted high above southeast London. What a sad irony that a discarded match or cigarette had managed what even the Luftwaffe. Hermann Göring couldn't do it, but a fag did do it. Burned down Mill's main stand.
You were discarded by some Dulwich fan.
Probably.
Or some Tooting and Mitcham fan. Of course, there would have been a lot of rubbish would have been collected under stands in those days, wouldn't they? And everything would have been highly flammable.
I mean, James here described it well, Neil. It was a crippling blow, he says, one that the club has never truly recovered from. This book was written, listeners, in the mid-80s, or just before the promotion season, because we would recover from it with the construction of the new Den, although that would nearly bankrupt us. But it's just interesting how that incident, those two incidents, particularly the fire though in 1943, transformed us from possibly being ready for first division football to never really being anywhere close to it after that.
Yeah, we always remained little old Millwall, didn't we?
From that point onwards, I think, yeah.
That's
how it was.
Do you know what? I'm just thinking about it. Would we want it any different?
That's another what if, isn't it? It's a good question. It's a what if, isn't it? It's a what if. I mean,
I don't want to support
Well, we could have been supporting Arsenal, a version of Arsenal. I think that's probably the best way to put it. The club.
And would we be sanitised? Well, we'd have probably been kicked out of football a long time ago, wouldn't we?
In the aftermath of the stand burning down, the club had... We've never wanted for ambition, listeners, in our club. We've always had it. They tried to get resources, which weren't forthcoming because of the Second World War, to build a new massive double-decker stand, which would have taken the ground cap 60,000 if that had come off. But the... 60,000. That would have been almighty. I mean, Highbury in its time would have been about that size, because it was all terracing back then, wasn't it? That was the aim.
The terracing went back a long way in those times, didn't they? And whereas three people could probably stand in the space of one person.
Absolutely. And I suppose pre-war we were getting the crowds. And they wanted to get ready for post-war, because by 43, it's still a way to go yet, but there was a general sense that the war was no longer going Germany's way, and everyone started to think about what came next. But it's a good question that you're posing, actually. I've never thought of that. Because history turns on these things. History turned on that cigarette, that's for sure, because that took us away from being, until then, luckily escaped the privations of war in a physical sense. But after that, we were devastated. And
considering that we were probably the nearest football ground to the docks, wouldn't we? Been back then, West Ham would have been slightly a little way back from it.
Yeah.
And Palace in the middle of nowhere, a suburbia. There was no chance of that place getting improved, was there?
James makes a really interesting point. I've never thought about this, Neil. I'm just reading as I'm talking. Talking about the devastation to Bermondsey, New Cross, also to our old home on the Isle of Dogs. The old ground was badly blitzed. It says the famous old Islander pub. Perished in enemy action. And this is a point that struck me. And so too did many homes of traditional Mill supporters who, after being bombed out from the area, and I include my own family in this, bombed out from the area and never to return. My family moved out to Downham and then we went to Nottingham. And I think that story probably went for many, many people. So, you know, your links become more tenuous the further away you get from the ground. You lose that tight-knit sense that the club has always been built on, especially back then. It's an interesting thought. I'd never thought of that, the effect of bombing in the sense of dispersing, beginning a process, and it would disperse the area generally, which is, you see now, you know, many of our fans don't live near the ground anymore, do they? So, interesting. Never thought of that. They mentioned Bill Voisey, First World War hero, escaped death when he was the victim of a blasting, though he clung on to the Mills manager job for as long as he could, not for gain, but purely in the interests of Millwall Football Club. Fascinating stuff. That would devastate the ground. The war would conclude, Neil, in 1945 with Millwall in a World Cup final. It was described here by Charles Buchan, who was a famous journalist. Produced an annual, didn't he? An annual soccer annual for kids, Charles Buchan soccer annual.
Arsenal player. International.
But Millwall would reach the final of the War South, the League South Cup. It has various names. War Cup, I don't think it was ever called that officially, but that was his unofficial name. Would get beat by Chelsea 2-0 in the final. Described by Charles Buchan as one of the poorest he's ever seen.
Yeah, well, that's because I think Chelsea drew in players from all kinds of clubs and we played by the rules.
Get ready for the rest of our lives, you know.
That and the fact I think we had Sam Bartram from the Spotters in goal, didn't we?
Yeah. 90,000 crowd. Watched by the Queen, our current Queen Elizabeth II was there wearing ATS uniform, which was the auxiliary service. I think it was like an assistance for, you know, driving and various labouring kind of things and stuff like that. So mechanics, I think she famously trained as a car mechanic during the war. 90,000 people were present. I think there was probably a real hunger. This took place in April 1945. The war had maybe a few more weeks to go before Hitler would die and Germany would surrender. And that was Millwall's Cup final until the late 1990s. Our only ever appearance at Wembley, of course, wasn't it? Famous images from the day, the Millwall team meeting the King and the Princess Elizabeth, as she was then in the crowd. It's I think as we've said already, and probably don't want to flog it, but the club came out of the war a fraction of what it was when it went into it, and it took a long, long time. Maybe we'd never really recovered from it. I don't know. Certainly, our history turned at that point, and we produced one of the poorest cup finals that George Buchan has ever seen. His life.
And this was the South final, because obviously then it was split into South and North, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it was North final. Yeah, yeah.
And Bolton beat Manchester United over two games. Funnily enough, 90,000 in Wembley, and both of those games attracted 40,000 each. And then they went to Stamford Bridge for the final. Chelsea lost 2-1 in front of 35,000. So there's probably about 90,000 Millwall fans in that ground.
We've always pulled a big crowd at Wembley, haven't we? We always managed to get the fans that maybe haven't been down there for years turn out for these games. And so there is nothing new in this life, as I've been told a few times over my
there was something, 6 years. I forget where I saw it now. Somebody put on Hoff. Was it on Hoff or did somebody tweet us? Mm. Did somebody tweet us a sign that they had the programme signed by both teams?
I think I have seen that, and I don't know if I've got a photo of it here in my... But I have seen that, yeah.
Tweeted us a long time ago, didn't they, with some memorabilia.
A post-match dinner, I think. I think I've seen the menu. I'm sure it's... Let me get my Dropbox. You can't see this, listeners, so I'm going to tell you what I can see. That's going to be the most frustrating bit of radio footage you'll ever have, where you can't see what I can see. There it is, the Football League South Cup final celebration dinner. So it'd be the post-match dinner, I guess, for both clubs. Do you want to hear the menu, Neil, what they had?
Go on, then.
My French accent is going to be suffering. So if any French speakers out there hear this, laugh at me. Timbale de homard à l'américaine. Timbale de homard... Timbale? What's that? I don't know what timbale is. Timbale de homard à l'américaine. Riz piaf. Pilaf rice? Riz... I can imagine the players going through this, can't you? Then we have that was a starter.
Then we definitely wouldn't have a pilaf rice for a starter now, would we?
Volaille, what is volaille? Is that, that's not chicken, is it? Volaille, du Surrey, volaille du Surrey en casserole au primeur, casserole. I'm gonna have to look volaille up. Well, bear with me, listeners. Pommes macaires, so potatoes. Salad parisienne. I know what that is. That's a Parisian salad. What's volaille in French, Neil? Come on.
Mate,
you're a match-travelled man. You know,
mate, I haven't even commanded the English language, let alone bloody started on the...
It's poultry. It's chicken. Volaille. I thought it was chicken. Volaille. Sorry, chicken. Sorry, chicken. chicken casserole, basically.
So did they make it in Surrey?
It's a chicken casserole, basically. That's their main course. With some potatoes and then a Parisian salad. I don't know what goes... Listeners will have to correct me on what the Parisian salad is. Salad cream or something like that. Then we have Savarin au fruit Melba and Rocher de glace vanille. So ice cream and fruit. For their afters with coffee. It all sounds much less impressive when... I'm going to have to look up what timbale is now. I'm curious, listeners. I didn't expect to be closing the show out on this, Neil.
On French recipes, even I've just had a look to see what a Parisian salad is.
Vegetable timbale.
Yeah, anybody that knows me knows that I do swerve a salad. And it appears as if it's one small can of sweet corn rinsed and drained. Neil and Nick's cooking hour here, isn't it? 4 slices of ham cut into strips, 100 grams of Gruyere cheese, finely diced.
Very nice.
2 tomatoes, diced. Uh-huh. 2 boiled eggs. Sliced or quartered, and 6 beautiful lettuce leaves.
I've found out what timbale is now as well. I've looked that up, listeners. It's like where you have your rice and you kind of, you can't see that, which is where you make a little shape out of it, like a little cup shape, and it stands up. That's called a timbale, apparently. When we set off, the people are gonna, I'm probably gonna get messages now saying how disrespectful this is, but I don't think it is. I think the boys at the in the game would have respected this. We finish up with their dinner, and that's really,
yeah, well, that's not bad considering that there was rationing involved at that time.
No, I know. So,
yeah, well, you wouldn't have got a decent sized portion, but they've been like the press room at Twickenham where the guy, yeah, where Andrew, the guy that hands it out, never met a stingier man in my life.
There we are. That was what they had in the aftermath of their 2-0 loss against Chelsea in the World Cup. I hope you've enjoyed this, listeners. We didn't really have much shape. I wanted to try and get a certain sense of remembrance. For me, is a wider thing than just the kind of, it includes all of the loss that comes with conflict. And I think we tried to touch on that because obviously it impacted both in the sense of losing loved ones and, you know, civilian loss, military loss, but also just the sheer economic impact of it all. I mean, it cost us everything, cost the country everything, certainly cost Millwall everything. And there we are, and we finish up with
paying for this war for years, weren't we? I think we were indebted to the Americans until what, the
quite recently,
your 90s, weren't we?
Yeah, quite recently. But we had a nice chicken casserole.
You to cheer us up. Trivialise it. And please, please don't take offence.
It's not meant in that way. It's meant as a tribute to all those, because I think that was the story of the conflict for everyone. It was also about survival as much as it was.
Yeah, we've tried to look upon the human aspects of it, I think. I think that sometimes we go too dark on things.
Easily done. And it's that time of year where people, you know, it's remembrance is important. But I think you have to keep a sense of...
We do remember.
We do.
We don't forget.
No, absolutely. And I think it's a sense of appreciating the thing in the round. It has an impact that goes way beyond the obvious, if you like. I don't know if that makes any sense, listeners. I think we've probably done enough, Neil, don't you?
I think we've probably done enough damage to our reputation. Yeah, but let's not also forget that we are actually talking about remembrance on a show with Achtung.
Attention. Yeah.
In the title. But no, we don't, you know, we don't mean any offence by making it lighthearted. We do.
No, it's intended to be to
all of those people that did give up their lives. I know that one of my granddads died just before the war, and the other one served on the convoys.
Tough job.
So
it's interesting. I mean, I did. I'm just going off at a tangent now, listeners, but similar to what you're describing there, Neil. I did. There's an app, Ancestry.com, which I find it when you go on it, it's addictive for a while. And then after a bit, you can't keep doing it because you can just go on and on and on and on. But one of my relations, I didn't know, we'd never spoken of in the family, but one of my aunts, great aunt, I suppose, she would have died at Surrey Docks on the September the 7th in the opening wave of the Blitzkrieg, caught out in the open, and she's registered as a death. Now, there's nothing unusual about that story, and you've described of your relations there, Neil, is a story of all of us. So, you know, it affected every single family, and, you know, in some ways it continues to this day, and I think that's really the point of remembrance. So I hope we've done it some form of tribute in our own special way. Please do let us know what you think about it. Big thank you to Neil for joining me for this one-off show. Thank you, mate.
Cheers, mate. Yeah, well, we'll be back soon, ready to...
Yeah, international break this week, so we'll be back soon as the month proceeds with our fixture show for next month. So until then, dear listeners, thank you for listening. Arrivederci, Neil. There's a big thank you from Neil and myself, and all the best to the next show.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.